Good morning, my pretties.
We now present Dracula by Bram Stoker, freely adapted for radio by P.J. O'Connor. We advise listeners who are nervous, or who may be alone or with children, that parts of this program are quite startling. Here with me in the studio, waiting to introduce the play, is Count...
Good evening. Dracula speaking. Count Dracula. Do not switch off. Don't even try. You cannot, even if you wish to. The undead live through one another. Listen. No, that is not in your imagination. You really heard my friend of the night. Listen again. Yes, the call of the wolf, the call of the undead seeking help. Don't close the window. I can get to you anyway.
And if you want to get your fangs into Dracula, a dedicated Bram Stoker hub can be found at rte.ie/culture, where they dug up this archive recording. I'll stop the voice now. But it was the cholera epidemic of 1832 that partly inspired the writing of that book, and this was the focus of the history show. Mary Muldowney, Dublin City Council historian in residence, joined Miles Dungan to dissect the links between cholera, vampirism and the writing of Dracula.
Why did people associate cholera with vampires? Is there any logical explanation?
Absolutely none at all, except that cholera, you did ask for a logical explanation. Cholera, a very severe case of cholera, and of course there were many, especially in 1832, the face kind of sunk. So somebody who was a cholera victim, their skin turned blue because the blood was more or less coagulating in their veins. I apologise to anyone for whom this is a bit gruesome, but literally the face kind of sunk and assumed a rather skull-like appearance. So you could see the association with that kind of death. And of course, Stoker had more or less been brought up on stories about the cholera epidemic from his mother and from the housekeeper where he lived. So that, you know, he was hearing about a lot, particularly of the Sligo infection.
And here is an account from Charlotte Thornley, Bram Stoker's mother, which she wrote down at the behest of her son.
In the days of my early youth, the world was shaken with the dread of a new and terrible plague, which was desolating all lands as it passed through them. And so regular was its march that men could tell where next it would appear, and almost a day when it might be expected. It was the cholera, which for the first time appeared in Western Europe. One action I vividly remember. A poor traveller was taken ill on the roadside, some miles from the town. And how did those Samaritans tend him? They dug a pit, and with long poles, pushed him living into it, and covered him up quick, alive. Severely, like Sodom, did our city pay for such crimes. Trenches were now cut across the roads in the direction in which the cholera was said to come, concisely for the purpose of stopping all intercourse with the infected districts. No use, no use.
Of course, that cholera outbreak was not unique to Sligo, and Mary Muldowney tracked its relentless march across the globe.
It moved through Russia, across Poland, particularly through Germany, eventually reaching Britain in 1831, and then came into Dublin and Belfast in the early part of 1832, and by the summer and the autumn was really, had taken, you know, was all over the country, and some horrific outbreaks. And of course, not only was Stoker hearing the family stories, especially of the Sligo outbreak, but when he was a young adolescent, he would have been living in Buckingham Street, which was not too far away, across the road almost, of a very poor slum area where the effect of cholera literally killed thousands.
And the eventual cure for cholera was clean water and public sanitation. But from such human loss and grief, great art did emerge. So, might there be someone somewhere right now channeling all our COVID anxiety into something creative and possibly sublime?
Do you expect that we have a modern day Bram Stoker sitting down at the moment to write about the current pandemic?
Oh, I imagine so, yes. I mean, it's just begging to be written about. So how it's treated, we'll have to wait and see.
Mary Muldowney on The History Show. Oh, and if you're planning ahead for some unusual stocking fillers, maybe think about this one.
If you were wealthy enough to be getting a fairly decent tomb, a bell would be incorporated into it, the tomb, so that if you did wake up and find that you had been buried alive, at least you could draw people's attention to it.
Ooh, a coffin bell in a selection box, please, Santa. And we were reminded again of how pandemics and plagues might inspire when Stephen Fry spoke to Wayne Tuberty on Thursday. His book Troy is a retelling of the Greek classics, and Fry spoke about the origins of the Iliad.
I presume you see in Troy, and in most history, particularly the epic stories, you see a salutary, I don't know if warning is the right word, but certainly a salutary tale.
Yes, I think what's wonderful about it is that although it's the Trojan War and it's the siege of a city, well, every element of it is so profoundly human and is to do with our weaknesses and faults, our vanities, our rage, our love, betrayal. All those things are what animates the story and makes it last as long as it has lasted. And, you know, to be reintroduced to it as I was a year or so ago when I started re-researching and going into it, I was just staggered by how close to our life it is. I mean, there's a horrible fact is that the Iliad, which is Homer's famous epic poem, which is about a short period towards the end of the Trojan War, the incredibly important period, and it starts with a plague. It starts with a disease sweeping through the Greek camp and the horror that it brings. And amazingly, the way Homer describes it, it starts with the animals.
Right. Oh, my
and
gosh.
It goes from the animals to the humans.
Yeah.
Zoonotic, as we call it grandly these days. Mm. And all that talk about bats and pangolins and things in China. Mm. As soon as I saw that that news, I was reminded of the Trojan War, of how and was it an insight that Homer had or Homer's people, that when you had a plague, it often started with the animals? I mean, the way he describes it, Apollo storms down from Olympus with and fires plague arrows into the Greek camp, and they hit the animals first, and the animals become sick, and then the humans get it. But it gave me real pause when I saw that. I thought,
oh, that's quite interesting. That was Stephen Fry talking about his book Troy. But then, halfway through the conversation, they detoured off and sat down in Pedden's Corner.
The one that's driving me crazy at the moment, which is, you got this. Don't tell me. What have I got?
Stephen, it's driving me mad. Like things like, they reached out to my people. You know, they
reached out.
Reached out. Or to your point. Or we're going to drill down on this now, or we're going to unpack that.
Drill down to the granular detail.
That's it. Are we going to unpack this argument piece by piece? You're going, well, what happened to language? It was fine. It wasn't broken. Stop fixing it.
It's weird, isn't it? I don't want to get so... I mean, I try not to be a language snob. I mean, I don't mind people using language in unusual ways or, you know, splitting infinitives or whatever. But it's just the endless batting and forward of clichés. And people describe me as, oh, you're dropping your new book, are you?
Oh, yeah, dropping a new book. That's because they're dropping a new series on Netflix. And then you get pushback. You're getting pushback?
I think it's important to laugh at it.
Listen, laugh at it, and then when they come in to feast on your innards, to ignore them, because we're just trying to have a laugh.
I said to a friend who works in radio like you, I said, see if you can say to your interviewees that you will cut them short and not mention their book or their film or whatever it is if they start a sentence with the word so.
Oh, very good. Well, that's the interview over. We wouldn't have a radio show.
You really wouldn't,
no,
would you?
No, not at all. We'd all be taken off. So, Stephen, it's been great to have you on the... But you said...
Ooh, let it all out, but move over in the bed, because here comes Fiona Looney.
The fact is that most of the new phrases are horrible. Like, there are very few nice phrases. Like, coronavirus at the start was kind of okay because it made you think of Danny O'Reilly or Corona beer or whatever. But we've kind of, that's gone now, isn't it? Like coronavirus is kind of the Betamax of the virus now because it's just COVID, which is a horrible word. But then, you know, wet pubs. Who knew that that was what pubs were all these years that we've been having a great time in them? The super spreader. I mean, that's a horrible thing. And yet we were all brought up to think that anything super is inherently good. But I have to say the one that irritates me most of all, and you would not believe how many times a day we all hear this now, is the foreseeable future. And like as a kind of a pedant, it drives me mad because obviously...
Oh, keep the pedantry going. Yeah, hook that into my veins, Fiona. Yeah. Tell me the pedantry.
Well, because obviously the fact is that if any single part of the future was foreseeable, we wouldn't be in this mess in the first place. So it's a very redundant phrase.
Fiona Looney with Colm O'Regan wants a word on Bank Holiday Monday. And ever mindful of the phrases that grate, we turn to sport, and specifically watching sport. Perhaps not quite the cathartic release we've been told. At least not according to Professor of Psychology Orla Muldoon, who spoke to Philip Boucher-Hayes yesterday.
I guess there's very strong evidence that sport and exercise is good for you, but it's the participation in it, not the watching of it. And I was getting a bit weary of listening to people talking about the mental health benefits for us all by watching a match. And that is just simply not true for everyone. So I felt the argument that was being pushed by some people was really in support of their sport, not in support of mental health. So I just wanted to step in and say, if we're serious about mental health, there are things we can do. And one of them is participating in sport. So as well as the people who will feel very isolated if they have to watch it alone, there's also a group who really don't care, and they're maddened by the fact that we're all supposed to be, you know, we're all supposed to care about team sports, or we're all supposed to care about the horses or the dogs. Mm. Some of us don't. We just want to go to the park and do our exercise class.
Oh, Professor Muldoon will set Des Cahill on you. But an interesting argument, until she went here.
Do you know, I have a brother-in-law from Mayo. He is a big, fully paid-up Mayo supporter, and he appears to think that they're going to win every year. So he you know, he might...
You're horrible. You're absolutely horrible.
He might be convinced he should bet every year. So there is the kind of over-involved supporter could actually bet in a way that clearly... you know, if you were looking at that, the odds aren't in Mayo's favour.
Not even going to back refer a person talking to Philip yesterday. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Faith, either lapsed, renewed, entirely absent, or something in between, all featured on the airwaves this week. Journalist Ellen Coyne has written a book about growing up Catholic, rejecting that religion and then returning to it, albeit reluctantly and with caveats. She spoke to Brendan O'Connor.
I suppose like a lot of people around 18, you kind of fell away from the church then. But you say that in the 10 years that you were, you call it a lost sheep, that you always had a little bit of a yen there. You had Catholic FOMO, you call it.
Yeah, like I think like so many people my age, as soon as I physically could get away from the church, I did and I wanted to. And I just thought it was a relic and I thought it was dark. But when you decide to leave the church, you never actually consciously decide to not believe in God anymore. And while I definitely wasn't what anyone would categorize as a good Catholic or even a good person of faith over those years, in times of crisis, I would always turn to prayer instinctively and not even think or question what I was doing. And if I would, in those times of crisis, turn to prayer, like it would never occur to me to question or doubt that someone else would be there. But I just arrogantly, when I threw away going back to the church, to the physical institution, I just threw away everything else that went with faith with it and stopped kind of, I guess, what people would describe as actively practicing. And I was so wrapped up in the problems that I had with the institution that I just became really arrogantly convinced that Catholicism or religion is something that I would just never, ever need again in the rest of my life, that it was just becoming obsolete. People my age would just be kind of quietly averting our gaze as the institution kind of died away in front of us. And also I became convinced that not being part of the church was the morally right thing to do, because there were so many things that it espoused and taught that I thought were wrong and that I fundamentally disagreed with.
And with the FOMO, Brendan wondered how Ellen filled the spiritual gap, if indeed there was one.
Did you do that thing that, I don't know, in my era, people would lapse from the church, but they would fill the need, I think, usually with the kind of Eastern mysticism section in Waterstones or whatever. But did you find other things that kind of gave you the religious feel?
At first, no, because when I left in that kind of teenage rebellion stage, which I'm sure was very like exasperating for my parents to watch, I went into my early 20s, and it's a point in your life when you're just fundamentally really self-centered and really selfish. Mm. So I wasn't thinking about it too much. But I thought it was interesting how, you know, as people my generation, the kind of millennials, get older, I've seen other people seek out things like horoscopes or different religions or, you know, kind of spirituality through yoga. And it's always so, people my age are so accepting about it and it's never really questioned.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you were to turn around and say in a bar, you know, I think I'm Catholic, they're a huge loaded thing to say that carries a massive question mark over it. And it's almost the opposite of the way it used to be in old days where people would say they were Catholic and it would be a sign of virtue. I think now to say you're not Catholic if you're my age is actually a sign of virtue.
And although Coyne had some very serious disagreements with Catholic teaching on many issues like same-sex marriage and abortion, she continued to feel the pull of the Catholic Church.
I started trying to talk to anyone in the church who would talk to me about the questions that I had. And I went one day to meet a priest, and I was early, so the parochial house sits next to a church, and I went in to just pass some time. And at this little chapel, they had a bench at the very back that was pressed against the wall, and then there was a little gap and all these pews. And there was like a dozen people in there, and it was the middle of the day on a weekday. And I noticed that the people had, like, there was a woman who had Brown Thomas bags and there was a woman who had her groceries. And it seemed like these people had like taken a break from their day to go in to get something that I couldn't understand. And I felt like the gap between the seat that I was on and the pews was widening. And I felt really upset suddenly because I was watching all these people in private prayer and I couldn't really understand. I felt like they had something that I couldn't really imagine having. And I felt like I was so far away from the position that they were in. And I think I started to feel kind of jealous as well. So I got upset and I left, and I was talking to the priest and asking all these like really demanding existential questions about whether or not it would be right to go back. And he was turning the questions back on me to my frustration. And in the end, he was like, you know, what is motivating you? And I blurted out that I'd felt really jealous and envious when I was sitting in the church next door, and actually, to my humiliation, could feel tears blooming at the back of my throat. And before I knew it, I was crying in front of this priest that I barely knew. And he was talking, and he basically suggested, you know, that feeling of missing something, or that feeling of something missing, is a very strong thing. And while I know that people will say that if you go and you want something badly enough, you can convince yourself that you had like some sort of religious experience. But he was saying that you can't make faith happen just because you wanted to. And having a feeling that strong probably did mean something. And it was just terrifying because I think I realised for the first time that if I went through this and decided that not going back to the Catholic Church was the right thing to do, I actually stood to lose something that I really, really wanted.
Journalist Ellen Coyne with Brendan O'Connor. And if she was returning to the Catholic Church, well, Owen Paul O'Rourke was leaving it. And his story was included in Ray Darcy's book, A Page from My Life, Stories from a Nation in Lockdown. He wrote about meeting his mother one Saturday in Bewley's in 1995.
We went in and sank into a big red booth. "I'm gay," I announced before her coat was off. "I know," she said. "You might as well tell me your hair is a different colour. It doesn't make a difference. I love you. I love you as you are, as God made you." My heart exploded in gratitude and tears slid down my face. She held my hand and listened and listened and listened. Suddenly she jumped up. "Oh my God, what time is it? We'll miss Mass." I couldn't bring myself to tell her my second secret, that I no longer went to church. Judging by her smile as we sat into the pews of St. Theresa's, though, I guessed she already knew.
And it wasn't just that he was not going to Mass, because when Owen spoke to Ray Darcy, he talked about having lived in Rome as a priest until he had decided to leave.
And obviously, again, all that was part of it, Ray, you know, trying to figure out who you are. You know, in life, it's never black and white, as all those stories tell you. It's never straightforward, you know.
And this is a big question, because we've only started the show and I've only met you. But yeah. was in any way going into priesthood sort of sanctuary from your sexuality?
Not a chance. It's the first thing I said to my spiritual director. He nearly fell off the chair. I said to him, you know, he asked after our first session, he said, "Have you anything you want to say?" And I said, "Yeah," I said, "I'm a gay man." I said, "But I figure I can be a celibate gay man as well as a celibate heterosexual man." And it wasn't a factor in that, in the sense of, for my own case, and that was one thing I believed, you know, that I could be celibate and a gay man. And a priest. And it's ironic that my brother's a priest. And, you know, we get on very, very well, even though we're chalk and cheese, but we love each other deeply. And we have very different opinions and things. And the whole idea of gay marriage was, you know, was an interesting thing, because I was kept on saying, "Well, I presume you're going to vote yes." And he would say, "Well, I don't know, you know," because obviously, again, him being a priest and all that. And it was interesting because we had one kind of very animated discussion one night when I brought out Panty's speech from the Abbey. And he said to me a very poignant thing, because for people in religious life in Ireland, it's not easy either. And he said, Panty had talked about checking herself at the crossroads, you know, at traffic lights. And he said, "Well, do you realise I have to do that nowadays, because people drive past and shout all sorts of things from the car."
Owen Paul O'Rourke with Ray Darcy on Thursday. And Philip Boucher Hayes was citing scripture when he spoke to Pastor John Ahern, spokesperson of the Irish Churches Together group. He's one of 70 pastors attached to evangelical churches who were warning government of the mental health impact of Level 5 restrictions on churchgoers in particular.
You know, there's a saying, no man is an island. And like Christ said, man doesn't live on bread alone. And so, you know, we're certainly seeing the effects of that in terms of depression, despair, self-harm, feelings of isolation, and sadly, even suicide. Yeah.
Christ also said, Matthew chapter 18, verse 20, "For where two or three gather together as my followers, I am there among them." Is Jesus not saying clearly that to worship, you don't need to go to a church?
I mean, look, the church is people. It's not a building. And yet, for the last 2,000 years, Christians have been meeting on a Sunday to gather to worship. Majority churches have been doing, you know, online, whether Zoom or whatever. But, I mean, there certainly is a certain segment of society that can't access that.
But what about the telly, Philip wondered. And then we had a rather spectacularly timed dropout on the line.
I'm looking at Mass on television on RTE News now, right now. Most people should have televisions.
Yeah, it's one thing to be looking at it on a screen. There's a very different element, I believe, that happens. There's a supernatural element to when people come together to worship.
Oh, unfortunately, that line seems to have dropped.
You know, doing your G&T and a string vest at home.
Okay.
Yes. There's a crucial sentence missing there before we got to Springvest and GET. Because sorry, you dropped out there for a second, John. Just complete that thought for us, please.
Well, you know, like you said, there's a difference between being in a pub with your friends and knocking something back at home. And
oh, so many ways to fill in that gap there. But later that same day, Joe Duffy spoke to Father Garrod Walsh, and this was a slightly darker conversation. Father Walsh condemned COVID-19 travel restrictions from the altar, no less, linking it with the spirit of the Black and Tans.
With respect, Father Walsh, and by the way, you seem to, you were on the front page of the Kerry's Eye journalist rang us to tell us.
That wasn't my decision, Joe.
I know, but you knew what you were saying. You don't resile from...
Don't be putting words into my mouth.
I'm not, but well, you're here, you're on, you're live on radio.
Well,
you can say
you,
what
your,
you... I know, and you...
Your researcher
and,
rang up and asked
that's
me
fine.
I go on.
That's fine.
Well, I'd have been better off if I didn't.
Well, it's...
I could have finished my dinner, Joe.
It's surely of public interest. If a priest of the Catholic Church compares our government to murdering thugs...
Now, Joe,
which is what
they
the black
are your words, not mine.
Well, what are your words
they
then? What did
your
you
words.
Say?
I was talking about the disruption of public.
You said
worship.
The spirit of the Black and Tans is the way. This is. I'm. Stop me. Check me, please. And you're well able. The manner and you're well entitled. The manner in which faith is being treated by the government led him you to think that the spirit of the Black and Tans is very much alive and well.
The spirit of the Black and Tans, in terms of the disruption of life, they did. Terrible things, of course.
Now, as you might imagine, not all of the faithful who talked to Joe agreed. Some felt the restrictions kept people safe and healthy and prevented the spread of the virus. But when Pastor Matthew Brennan phoned in, he felt that everything was divinely created, including COVID-19.
In the world we presently are in, Joe, hope seems to be a deficit. And God of the scriptures and the God who's in charge of the virus needs to be known and comfort given and perspective brought. And it's only through the scriptures, as the gathered people gather, that we get another dimension which gives us hope and help.
And do you really believe God is in charge of this virus?
Joe, if I did not believe God was in charge of every single thing that happens in our world, he's not God. When rain falls from the ground, he knows what blade of grass is going to rest on. He has to be. Okay. If he's not in control of everything, then he cannot be God.
And then is it totally frivolous of me to say, if God is in charge of the virus, why won't he or
what
she
I'm saying,
take
Joe,
it away?
That God is sovereign in our world and nothing happens except by his sovereign purposes.
And what is the purpose of the virus?
Well, there's a big question, Joe. There's a big question. We've got to ask ourselves, why would such a thing come to us? And why would such a thing happen across the Western civilized world?
But why would a pandemic, why would you give a pandemic sentient feeling such as purpose? Do you follow me?
Because God is sovereign, Joe, we are the creature, he is the creator. We have lessons to learn. It tells us that we're not invincible, that we are not the masters of our own fate and the captains of our own destiny.
Liveline on Thursday. Well, one man who has grappled more than most with questions of faith and meaning is Michael Harding, and he's most comfortable in a middle ground of sorts.
You see, as I got older, I began to let go of the formality of religion or even spirituality. I began to feel more the sacredness of my body and the bodies of others around me. That said something without referencing an other world, without thinking of, you know, big theological ideas about is there a God or not, which is something that doesn't affect me in the slightest now. It's a redundant question. There are more deep and more fundamental questions to ask, and they're about being in the world. And being in the world, primarily in this body, and then being in the world in a way that relates to the wider world of other bodies and other phenomena in existence. And then ultimately a sense that, you know, there is some kind of presence. It's not entirely me in my own cosmos. I don't believe that. But it's not entirely the other as like a god or another being that's out there, you know, hiding behind the clouds and pulling strings like a puppeteer. So in that sense, I don't believe in the nihilistic approach of secularism, and I don't believe in the substantial compulsion or compulsive substantialism of religious faith. I'm happier in the middle ground. But living in the in-between, I think, is to live with an open heart and a heart that accepts everything coming towards it as mystery, so that your consciousness is in your heart and your knowing is actually your loving.
Michael Harding from Listening to Leaves. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Now, if last lockdown we had the sourdough, and quite a lot of it, this time around it seems to be sea swimming. Here's Brenda Donoghue on Like Family with Carol Ann down in Sligo.
Carol Ann didn't expect that a parenting trick her father used when she was a little girl would rescue her this year.
Well, I often remember when I was younger and say if myself and my sisters had a little fight, Dad would bundle us up into the car and he'd bring us down to the sea. And I think he always just felt that it had a calming effect on us. And it definitely did. Because every time that during our teens or our 20s that we were low or we weren't feeling great or college was getting too intense or we had a breakup, one of us would take the other out to the sea. And it really just brings this amazing calming, almost like say force, but there's such energy in it that it just grounds you. And I've rediscovered the sea again this year, and for me, Brenda, it's been life changing. It's gotten me through the really tough times, the anxiety, and it's just brought so many good times and friendships as well.
I'm standing here about to get into the sea in your lovely swimming togs in the rain. What are you thinking?
I get very nervous, excited, giddy almost, and hopeful. Yeah, they're all the kind of amazing emotions that you experience over one simple act of just jumping into the sea.
Togs, cold sea, do not know about that at all. Hardy souls, just don't tell Darcy. But if you're still working from home, I suspect the novelty of all of that has just worn off. The initial joy of gym jams at the desk, putting on the wash while you sent a few emails and maybe sneaking in a little bit of afternoon telly. Now though, I bet you'd be hanging for a memo to clean out the office fridge.
Tell me, old man, what was the office like in 2019?
Ah, the office. You know, we used to have a little thing called small talk, where of a Monday morning, you might ask someone about their weekend, and then you wouldn't listen to their ploy.
And what did you do after work?
Oh, after work, we had this thing called pints.
Pints? Like after work drinks?
Aye.
How did that work?
The guys, sometimes some of the girls, would leave the office and, well, just go to an old pub.
On your own?
Oh, no, in a group. We'd all stand by the bar, having the crack and what we used to call the banter, like.
To a pub? No masks, no booking, no food?
No.
More than 6 people?
Aye.
More than 90 minutes? Wow. Standing beside each other. A pub. That word sounds familiar.
Yep. And then we might crowd.
You'd crowd? Ew.
Yeah, crowd into a taxi. Go to an old club. More drinks. Hit the dance floor.
Dancing? Oh God, the aerosols. I think I might be sick, but I can't stop listening.
And you never know, you might get lucky.
You mean avoid infection?
Well, obviously we'd use protection, you know.
Surgical masks.
Yeah, something a bit like that, yeah.
From Colm O'Regan wants a word. On Arena on Tuesday night, there was a very meaty discussion about race. Kay Sheehy spoke to American poet and essayist Claudia Rankine about her book Just Us, An American Conversation, in which she talked with white friends and strangers on the topic of racism and white privilege.
I mean, you know, we've had 400 years of white people believing in the mythology that they own the space and that anybody else is an interloper, a visitor, an immigrant that shouldn't be here, and that this is their country. And, you know, people are pushing forward in, and we have over time, there have been, you know, the civil rights period, but now we're in another very overt push to demand the rights that are denied to us. I think partly because the killing of Black people, the bodies in the streets, is getting on everyone's nerve, to put it mildly.
And this getting on the nerves came close to home for Claudia one evening when she went to the theatre with a friend of hers, a friend who happened to be white.
You go into the play and you're just watching a family have create a birthday party for the matriarch. And then suddenly the play stops and starts again. And this time you hear white people talking about the Black characters in the play. And so the play clearly is around race. And at the end of the play, the character, the actor who plays the daughter, she comes and faces the audience and says, you know, do you think we could, you know, what if, that act of imagination, what if all the white people in the audience came up to the stage and left the space of the audience only for Black and brown people so that in the space of this theater, they could have something they don't have in the real world. They can, instead of them being the spectacle to be looked at, they could just inhabit this space. And could the white audience members just come up to the stage? And my friend, who was white, is white, she just sat there.
Beside you.
Beside me, and everybody else is going up, and I'm waiting for her to go up, and she's not moving, and I'm waiting for her to go up, and she's not moving. And I'm thinking, what is happening? And then when I realize she's not moving, I get really irritated, so irritated I can't even hear the end of the play, because I'm thinking, they just asked you to do something for, you know, 3 minutes. You're sitting here, they just ask you to take 5 steps up to the, and you cannot do that. You cannot even do that small thing. And so I got really, really angry in my way, which means, you know, internally angry. And so when the play was over, I turned to her and I said, I didn't know you were Black. And she doesn't answer me. And then we part. I remember it was raining that day. So we literally got outside and ran, my husband and I and my daughter, to the car.
Was it that she didn't want to be associated with white people who are in some way racist?
Well, she's racist, you know, like white people are innately racist. And she, you know, she knows that by virtue of being inside this culture.
Now, her friend would go on to explain that for her, she'd felt bullied and subject to some kind of diversity exercise. This wasn't an explanation Claudia accepted, although they were still friends. But for Claudia, the whole incident spoke to a wider truth about race.
And Claudia, when you say white people are innately racist, do you believe that of all white people?
Yeah, I think either you're anti-racist or you're racist. Like either you're actively working against the ways in which white people were brought up in this country, or you're racist. You know what I mean? That it's so, it's also a job for people of color to work against whiteness, the privileging of whiteness inside the culture. You know, so many examples of people, including Black people, you know, opening the door for white people and shutting it for Black people. So the whole culture is orientated towards the supremacy of whiteness and anti-blackness.
Poet and essayist Claudia Rankine with Kay Sheehy on Arena on Tuesday. Well worth a listen back. On the poetry programme, Olivia O'Leary was joined by Maria McManus, and she's involved in an initiative called Poetry Jukebox.
So the jukeboxes are about 6 foot tall. They are big blue steel tubes that come up out of the ground. They look a little bit like a ship's funnel.
And you can just walk up to one and pick a poem to listen to. And there are three of these jukeboxes dotted around the country. Here's why.
I want to make poetry accessible in surprising ways and in unexpected places. But also, actually, a recurring theme for me is there's a lot of very angry discourse in public space, a lot of nasty things often written on the walls or spoken in casual ways. So for me, it's also a way to put something beautiful and gentle and imaginative also into that public space.
And thoughtful.
Yeah. And reflective. I think that for someone who comes across a jukebox, there is an invitation within that to reflect, to listen, to pause, to put some small pool of introspection into your day.
Maria McManus on the poetry programme talking about the need to reflect, pause, and also maybe take a break from the angry discourse and nastiness spoken in casual ways. Might she perhaps be referring to this?
It's not where families don't talk to each other
because of
Trump since he got in. I am not talking rubbish. I am not. Look, anybody that supports Trump supports racism.
Yep, Trump and Biden supporters duking it out on Liveline, because when it comes to divisive, they don't get much nastier than next week's US election. Won't that be a pleasant change from the COVID, huh? Coincidentally, I'm off next week, so do enjoy. Thanks for listening. Talk to you in a fortnight. We just wanna...